What's up, everybody, and welcome to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Today, we have Sim and myself, Megan McGuire, and we are going to be chatting about some repayment plan tips, tricks, kind of things that we can deal with right now while we're in this, feels like we're in a waiting period, right, Sim?
What a mess is all I can say. I feel like that's the TLDR. What a mess. What have they done?
So we're going to chat through exactly how we're advising clients right now for what to do, how to think about their game plan once we know the result of this fight over the save plan. Let's first jump into some recent changes to the studentaid.gov website, where we saw that they started, and this is something to know, like they make changes to that studentaid.gov website, and there's a page specific to the save plan. It's like right on the homepage. It takes you right there. But they've been making updates to this pretty frequently. I would suggest checking that every so often if you're trying to get a pulse on what's going on, because they do make adjustments. And one of the most recent adjustments we saw, I think on the 30th of August, was they changed the language to say, hey, you can only really apply for two IDR plans right now, right? You remember seeing that, Sim?
This is such a big deal because we used to have so many more options for folks, and now we're down to two. And it's like, well, what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Some backstory, July 1 was the last, or basically that was when we would no longer be able to apply for the pay plan. They were sunsetting pay because the save plan came about. Repay has been long gone because save replaced repay. But with all this madness with the save plan being contested and argued over, the Department of Ed came out and said, hey, you could still actually apply for pay and ICR, which ICR is one of the other income-driven plans we rarely recommend, but that was a plan that also sunset July 1 as well. But they came out and said, hey, you could still go ahead and apply for these plans because we know that stuff is up in the air with the save plan. Basically, they were saying, go ahead and apply, submit a paper application for one of these two if you'd prefer these months to count towards your forgiveness timeline, because as we know right now, the save forbearance is not counting towards the forgiveness timeline. We were telling folks, hey, go ahead and do that. And then we found out from a lot of representatives at the servicers that they were being instructed not to process those IDR applications. And so maybe they're sitting on a desk somewhere. I don't know. What do you think they're doing with them, Sim?
I think they're lighting them on fire to keep themselves warm.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was frustrating to learn that basically they were saying, hey, yeah, go do this. But then to hear from the people actually like collecting those documents and processing them, or supposed to be processing them, like they've been told to sit on them.
Well, you can't even like do it online now. Like if you try to log online to do like, hey, I want to switch plans, I don't want to deal with this whole save nonsense, like you can't even do that. So I've been telling folks like just send it by certified mail, at least so they'll have it. They'll have it, hold on to it. And maybe when all of this, you know, stuff gets resolved, they'll process it.
Right. More recently, like a couple weeks ago, I was starting to tell folks like, hey, it may actually make more sense just to wait. Let's just wait this out. Let's not submit anything just in case. Because, you know, if the save plan is saved, then we don't want to actually have that application on file anymore. And there's no way to retract it once it's just, you know, sitting out there on a paper form. Been a lot of confusion there, right? A lot of trying to figure out what is the best thing to do, trying to think about, you know, what the next steps would be, like thinking a couple steps ahead, which is almost impossible to do, right? With all of these things changing so fast. But back to the language. So the language on the website changed where now it says you can only apply for IBR, income-based repayment. So that's the old or new IBR. Eligibility depends on when your first loan was borrowed, or the save plan. So they say you can still apply for the save plan, but now it says we don't have the option to apply for pay or ICR. They had some dates on there. Basically, it said if you had applied for pay and ICR between July 18th and August 9th, which is a very random period of time. I guess July 18th may have been when they come out, when they came out and said, hey, you could still apply, go ahead and submit an application. And then August 9th, I'm not sure what the rationale behind August 9th is, but basically they're saying like if you had submitted an application between that time frame, they'll still process it. And of course, if you had submitted a pay application before the like June 30th/July 1 deadline, like they'll still process that. But isn't that weird? Like those gaps of time between, like, how are they deciding if somebody got an application submitted by July 7th, This
Right.
is exactly why I tell people certified mail is so important because it gives you a record of when you sent it. I'm always like preparing my clients for a fight. I think I'm always just ready for a good fight, but you have to save your records and show, hey, I Yeah.
did this on this date and I can see that you got it on such and such date. So I'm good.
Right.
I'm in between the dates. You got to honor this. Megan, I was going to ask you, how does this impact Parent Plus borrowers?
Yeah, so ICR, income contingent repayment, is still available for Parent Plus borrowers. It is specifically carved out to where you could still apply if you have Parent Plus loans and you've consolidated your Parent Plus loans, you could still apply for ICR. The double consolidation, however, we still have the ability to do that as of right now until July of next year, 2025. But it seems like at this point, with double consolidations, we can only really be applying on that last consolidation for either IBR or save. And who knows what's going to happen with save. So we're starting to talk through like plan B is going to be IBR, income-based repayment, either new or old IBR, which is not a bad plan B if it's a new IBR, like we don't have loans prior to 2014, which a lot of newer Parent PLUS borrowers don't. Like their kids went to school in the past 4 years. That's good. That means the new IBR calculation is based on 10% of discretionary income. So it's not too far away from what the save plan was going to be at the 10% calculation. It does make for a good like backup plan, and it's a 20-year timeline to forgiveness, but this is a lot of what we're doing right now, right? Like talking through plan A, plan B, and plan C because we don't know what's going to happen. So it's good to have an idea of what's kind of the best to the worst case scenario.
Yeah, and sort of the good news, if you can call it good news, is that it does take a while to go through the double consolidation process. You're doing two sets of consolidations, back to back. And so it can make sense to start that process. And maybe by the time you're done with that process, we'll have some more clarity on the save plan.
Right. That's literally what I've been telling my double consolidation people. Like, hey, we're going to be in processing anyways for the next like 60 days, 90 days. So hopefully we get some new information by the time we're doing our final consolidation.
Yeah. So people are seeing payments due this month, people who are seeing save payments due. So what do we tell them? Should people be making payments right now?
So this is a good question. So kind of going back to the weird language on the save part of the studentaid.gov website. And also, one of the other things before we get to the payments, one of the other language changes on that website is saying that processing forbearances are going to count towards IDR and PSLF forgiveness for 60 days. So that just means basically, if you're in a processing forbearance, usually that happens is when you are consolidating and or when you're switching income-driven plans and they need time to be able to make the switch for you. So if you're in a processing forbearance, that time can count for up to 2 months is what they're saying. But the general forbearance, which everybody who's on save got thrown into, is not going to count. So I thought that was an interesting piece of information to where maybe we could argue or call the loan servicer to request a processing forbearance if we're trying to switch plans or if we have recently consolidated to try to get a couple months counting. But then, going into the payments due in September, we have been seeing a lot of people get payments or payment notices about things due in September. So should you pay? I think it depends, right? I
Our
think
favorite answer.
I know people want to punch us in the face when we say that, but when would you think it makes sense to pay? Because I don't know, I've got opinions on that, but what do you think, Sim?
I feel like a lot of people probably shouldn't. If you're not sure that it's going to count, we'll talk about some options later of ways that you can get this time to count. Honestly, it might make sense just to, ride out that $0 payment, the 0% interest onto your cash. You can make a payment later. I think for most people, that's probably what I would suggest.
I'm totally in the same boat because there's just so much uncertainty. With PSLF, we know there's a PSLF buyback option, which we'll talk about here in a little bit. But that just means that these forbearances that are not going to be counting right now, we could purchase later. We could pay a lump sum to purchase these months later. So there is a fallback option there for our PSLF folks. For our non-PSLF folks, these months don't count. We don't know if there's going to be some kind of buyback option. Maybe there is, but we don't know.
I'll tell you my crystal ball opinion. I think it's totally going to come down to the outcome of the election this November, depending on what administration we end up with. I think they might retroactively just count it anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point too. So that's like best case scenario. Like if they come back
Yeah.
and say, "Hey, sorry for all the stress, guys. We're gonna let these months count after all." My gosh, that would be great. But if not, maybe there's some kind of buyback option as well for the longer term forgiveness folks too, or there's maybe a way to petition to purchase those payments at like a, ad hoc perspective, like maybe with a complaint, for example. We'll talk about some other options there coming up. I think generally back to like, should you be paying in September during this pause if you've been thrown into forbearance? Probably not, because it may be a waste and there may be ways for you to be able to make up for it later, I think is really the main point there.
And then the other thing that we're seeing is that a lot of people are in a standard repayment instead of an income-driven repayment. Like maybe someone applied for save, like they did a consolidation or something and they didn't process it. And so standard repayment is the default. And when we talk about standard repayment, we mean standard 10 or the amount equivalent to standard 10, which depending on your loan balance can be a very large and prohibitive, to your cash flow amount. And so you do have some options. I think for most people, if you're going for forgiveness, I would make that payment. I would probably strategically request a forbearance, right? So that way, even if that month didn't count, you just tack on an extra month at the end of your timeline to forgiveness, but at least you've preserved your cash flow.
Right. You can ask for forbearance. You do have up to 36 months of forbearance available to you. They won't give it to you all at one time. Like they won't say, yeah, we'll put you in a forbearance for 3 years, right? That whole IDR waiver, that's what that's for. Like servicers got in big trouble for doing that because they did. They put people into forbearance for long periods of time. So they might give you a hard time on how long they're going to give you forbearance for. Maybe it's a month, maybe it's 3 months, but you have the right to up to 36 months of forbearance available. So that's good to know. You can argue for it, petition for it, advocate for yourself. But yeah, the standard payment likely is going to be a pretty high payment compared to your IDR, like what it should be. And so you could preserve that cash flow. And what I would suggest, and what we've said before, is go ahead and set that money aside, like how much you should be paying in anticipation of payments kicking back in later, and also in anticipation of maybe being able to buy those as a lump sum later on down the road.
Yeah, and then I would also stick those payments in a high yield savings account. If you're like, what do I do? Like, don't just stick it like under your mattress or like in a no interest savings account. Let it earn a little bit of money for you.
Yes. And high yield savings accounts are getting like upwards of 5% right now, which is pretty awesome. But man, I'm just going to pause for a second to tell the folks, like, if you're on pay as you earn or IBR, wow, your life is good right now, isn't it? Because you don't have to worry about all this like craziness. I had a couple clients yesterday. Our game plan for their financial plan and for their student loan plan was to stay on pay until we had to recalculate their payment, because then it would make sense for them to switch to save, but we didn't want to make their payment higher earlier. And pay was a good like second option, like a backup option if save wasn't going to work. But I met with them yesterday and it was such a relief to just be like, man, yeah, just keep making your payments. We're good.
It's counting towards forgiveness. There's no ambiguity, peace of mind. They're sleeping at night.
Yeah. So I'm sorry for those that are on the save plan and going through this heartache, this frustration. It is very frustrating, but I am hoping that we're going to have some retribution in the future in some form or fashion to be able to make up for some of the madness that's going on right now.
So, Megan, how does someone get on forbearance since we were kind of talking about? That's a question we get a lot. Do I have to call somebody? Do I have to fill out a form?
There is a general forbearance application. You could Google this. Just Google like general forbearance application PDF. Try to put PDF at the end of it so it pulls up like the actual application itself. This is a standardized forbearance application where you could explain your reasoning for why you want a forbearance. It gives you a couple options for why you're requesting the forbearance. One is financial difficulty, which could rightfully be so if it's asking you for a standard payment, a really high payment, when it's supposed to be that income-driven payment that hasn't been approved yet because of all this madness. Another option is change in employment. If you had to drop part-time hours, if you're out on maternity leave, not making the same income, or you're between jobs, you could request WES for that reason. Medical expenses, or there's an other box, and you can explain the situation. So you could use, I think, any of these options, whatever's applicable to you, but the other box could be a good place for you to kind of explain that you're waiting for the save application to be processed because you submitted it a while ago, or you're waiting for the pay application to be submitted and processed because you submitted that a while ago. You can kind of list out what your reasonings is there and upload that to your servicer's portal. Every servicer has an online portal where you can upload documents, and usually it's in like the document section, or I think that's what it's called for all of the servicers.
Yeah, usually it says like messages.
Yeah, there's like a message section too. So upload that there, or you can give the servicer a phone call, whatever makes more sense for you. There probably will be some wait time with a phone call, so maybe multitask at the same time, clean something, cook dinner while you're calling. But that could be how you go ahead and get into the forbearance. And ideally, if you can ask for a processing forbearance, that would be good, especially if you are legitimately waiting on them to process an application for you, because that processing forbearance, as we have now learned with the new language update, should count for up to 60 days. So that's something there.
And we're kind of talking about this as a temporary solution just because of people being placed onto standard. But like if you are on maternity leave or, you know, God forbid you have cancer, like those are time periods that could still count for PSLF. So just everything's kind of case by case.
Yeah, this is definitely during this weird time where, like, if there is a large payment coming due and you cannot afford that payment, or you do not want to make that payment because it's much higher than what an income-driven payment would be, then that's where the forbearance makes sense, because we can't quickly switch to a different plan or quickly recalculate your payment. That's really what it comes down to here. Normally, we wouldn't be recommending forbearance. We'd be saying, hey, update your payment, make that payment affordable, but there's no way to do that right now because they're not processing anything. So,
Yeah, that's why I've been calling it strategic forbearance. Like we're doing this with a strategic intent. That's not actually the name of a type of forbearance that exists, but that's why we're doing it. It's intentional.
Yes, intentional. So let's see what else. We've had a couple questions about the partial financial hardship requirement for some of these income-driven plans, like income-based repayment, for the pay-as-you-earn payment. We've also had folks ask, could I just apply for the standard 10-year plan? And why someone might be asking that is because the standard 10-year plan payment technically counts towards PSLF, and the income-driven plans have a partial financial hardship, except for save, except for repay, where the payment can't go above a certain amount. And so the question we'll get is, well, if someone's trying to keep their payment lower, they want to make sure they're maximizing their forgiveness timeline or choosing the right income-driven plan if save is not going to work out. The question might be, should I just apply for the standard 10-year plan? And the answer is, you're probably not going to be able to, and probably not. And the reason why is because if you have consolidated your student loans, which many people have for one reason or another, but if you've consolidated your student loans and your balance is over 60,000, your standard 10-year payment, it's not 10 years. They spread the amortization schedule out over 30 years. So you can't simply request or ask to be put on the standard 10-year plan because they're going to automatically amortize it over 30 years. But does that make
So
sense how I'm explaining
basically,
that? Yeah.
yeah. So maybe said differently is that the default before you consolidate your loans, right? The default is standard 10. If you don't pick anything, if you don't do anything with your loans, and when you graduate, you will be on standard 10. Once you consolidate, the definition of standard is no longer 10. It is now based on what is your loan balance. And so they kind of have these like break points, so like 0 to 7,500 and 7,500 to, I don't know, 15,000, something like that. But it goes from like there's a 10 year, I know there's a standard 20. There's a standard 30. The standard 30 is if your balance is over 60,000, which most borrowers that we work with have. So it's weird. If you're confused, you're in good company.
Yeah, it is pretty confusing. And a lot of people don't know that. And so they think, oh, well, I could just go and apply for the standard 10-year, but they consolidated and then they get their payment back and it's way lower than they expected. And it's like, yeah, they amortize it over 30 years, not 10. And so that's not going to count towards PSLF. And that's the whole point, right? We want a plan that's going to be affordable towards the forgiveness path that you're going. So who can apply for the standard 10-year plan? Well, people who did not consolidate. So if you have loans that have never been consolidated for one reason or another, that's totally possible. We see it a lot. Then technically you can apply for the standard 10-year plan, but it's not as simple as them just amortizing the balance at that time over 10 years. Unfortunately, what they do, and what a deep dive into the language confirmed for me the other day and for another client the other day, was that basically it's like a hierarchy order of operation, and they take the highest payment. So that's why there's a lot of confusion around this, because it's not one answer. It's technically a couple different conditions, and whichever is the highest payment is which one they choose, if that makes
When you say
sense.
highest payment, you mean highest payment by dollar or months of payments made?
Dollar by dollar.
So, why
And
don't you give us
so,
an example?
yeah, so let's say you're applying for the standard 10-year plan. You have been in repayment, though, for 4 years on, let's say you were on the save plan, you're trying to switch to the standard 10-year plan to be eligible for PSLF. You have already been in repayment for 4 years. So the student loan system is going to take that into account, and they're going to take that 10-year amortization period, subtract the 4 years that you've already paid, and they're going to amortize your balance over the 6 years that are left. That's going to be one calculation. And then the next calculation is going to be, what would be your balance amortized over 10 years? That payment's going to be lower than what the 6 year amortization payment's going to be. So they're going to choose the 6 year amortization period. Can you pick and choose or argue over the lower amount? No, not based on how the language was written. And so that's why there's some confusion around that. Now, if you never were on a repayment plan, like you just started in repayment, could you go and apply for the standard 10-year plan and it be amortized over 10 years? Yes, because you haven't been in repayment. And that's going to be the highest payment calculation. It's kind of complicated. Like I've been listening to myself, like, this is a lot of math.
The moral of the story is that the house always wins, and they're going to pick the payment that does not favor you, but it favors them because they want you to pay more.
Correct. So, can you technically apply for the standard 10-year plan and it count towards PSLF? Yes, but it's going to be higher than an amortized balance over 10 years. It's going to be whatever time you have left. So, I've seen it like where it calculated something crazy because someone was in repayment for 8 years. They amortized it over the last 2 years left, and it was like a wild payment amount. And we were like, how are they getting this payment? And that's why, because they're choosing the higher of the two numbers. Pretty complicated there. Now, the good news is, let's go back to the partial financial hardship with IBR and with pay. So the good news is, if you're already on IBR or pay, the plan does have that partial financial hardship requirement, which says, hey, your payment can't be what the payment would be if amortized over 10 years. That is a true statement. They're not going to subtract how much time you've been in repayment to calculate that partial financial hardship number. They go off of when you first entered the income-driven plan, which is exciting. That's not exciting,
So
but it's
basically,
better.
whatever your payment would have been on standard 10, you graduated, you didn't pick anything, you're on standard 10, whatever that payment would have been, if they calculate your payment on IBR or one of the other plans as less than that amount, you have a partial financial hardship.
It sounds like really aggressive. You have to really not make a lot of income to qualify for a partial financial hardship. And we get the question a lot, right? Like, well, what's the most I can make? And it's like, it depends on what that calculation is, the 10-year calculation. So there's not really an income limit. It has to do with what was your amortized balance at the time when you entered your income-driven plan. Like, if it was amortized over 10 years, what is that payment? That's the standard 10-year calculation. And a great fast way to know what this is. A lot of people have been getting these notices lately, actually. And I'm sure your email has gotten blown up with it too, Sim, where
Yes,
someone
I know exactly the notice you're
you
talking
know what I'm
about.
talking about? Yeah.
Yes.
So they get this message, this PDF document from the servicer that says, "Hey, your IDR payment is, $500 a month until February 2025." And then February 2025, it shoots up to 4,000 a month. And we get all these panicked emails like, oh my gosh, why is my payment exploding next year? What did I do wrong? Am I not on the right plan? What they're saying is if you did not update your income, if you didn't recertify on time, that is what your standard 10-year payment would be. That's that cap on your income-driven plan, the pay plan or the IBR plan. You're going to get this as well. Even if you're on the save plan doesn't have a cap. If you don't recertify your income, they're going to throw you on the standard plan. So That's what that means. If you were wondering or panicking about like what's going to happen in 2025, technically it's not an error. They just don't explain that well in the letter that they send.
One sentence. All they had to do is add one sentence if you recertify, right? But no, they had to add more confusion to everything.
Exactly. All I have to say is if you were certified on time, this would not be the payment. It would
But
continue to be based off of income.
I bet you I know why they do it though. It's because they don't know what your income's going to be next year at
Yeah.
recertification. So they're just going off of your original balance.
Yeah, they're giving you like the worst case scenario, but that is a good indicator of what the maximum payment could be for you on your income-driven plan, which could be helpful if you're doing calculations and you're trying to figure out like, am I close to the cap? Am I ever going to reach the cap? And a lot of people don't because the balance, the math just doesn't work out to get there based on income. But
I think knowing that number can be very powerful because there's a misconception amongst a lot of like high income earners, like dentists and physicians. Well, we're not going to get loan forgiveness. We're just stuck paying these off. But depending on how much income you have, depending on how much you borrowed from medical school, that might not be a true statement at all.
Now, one last thing to mention on this partial financial hardship requirement, we have been seeing questions too about people concerned that they're on the SAVE plan, they're concerned that the SAVE plan is going to get repealed, and they're worried that they're not going to be able to apply for IBR or for pay or new IBR because they're not going to have a partial financial hardship at that point, right? Have you seen some of those questions?
Yeah, and I think that's a actually really legitimate question.
That is a legitimate concern because your income, SAVE didn't have a cap. So your payment could be whatever it was based on income and you would still qualify for PSLF. But if we don't have SAVE, repay is going to come back. So that's one thing to keep in mind. So there's a couple of things that I think we can help calm the nerves with. So repay will come back, which repay did not have a cap either. It does require you to include spousal income, though. So that might stink because if your spouse's income is not included in your SAVE payment right now, it will be on repay. But it is still a qualifying plan towards loan forgiveness. If you're really close to that timeline, might make sense just to hang out on repay until you get to the forgiveness threshold. Maybe we don't get as much forgiven as we thought originally, but it could still work out mathematically to continue that path. Another thing you can consider, if you didn't already, you could look at filing taxes married separately coming up for this upcoming tax year to see if that makes a difference on if you would qualify for the partial financial hardship in next year for with 2024 taxes. So that could
I've been
be
telling
something.
most of my clients, like, if you're not sure what to do and you're like, you don't want to run the numbers or whatever, like, go file separately because you have 3 years where you can amend that return from separate to joint, but you can't do the opposite. You can't be like, well, I filed a joint return and I want to change it. There's a saying in the tax world, you can make up, but you can't break up when it comes to amendments. You can make up, you can go from
That's
separate to
funny.
joint, but you can't break up. So if you need
Got
that
it.
flexibility, right? And a lot of people are nervous to file separately because they're like, is that like legitimate? I've never done that before. There are a lot of reasons why someone would choose to file separately. It has nothing to do with student loans. A lot of people do it because they don't want, to be liable for their spouse's income, right? Because you're jointly and separately liable. You're liable for your spouse's taxes, right? If they didn't pay enough and you file jointly, you're on the hook for that. So if you file separately, that's not the case. And that's a big reason why a lot of couples choose to file separately. So there's any number of reasons. It's totally legitimate. And you have 3 years to amend the return. So if you did see, like, hey, I ended up paying a lot more in taxes because I filed separately, you'll probably get a good chunk or all of it back.
Yep, amendments are definitely something you can have in your back pocket. And then one last thing I'll mention here, and then we'll move on to the PSLF buyback information. You can also use alternative documentation of income. Let's say you do file separately, your tax return shows your income, but it's higher than what you're currently being paid. Maybe you're not taking extra shifts anymore. Maybe you quit that part-time job, or maybe you reduce your hours, whatever the case. You can submit alternative documentation of income, which could also potentially get you below that partial financial hardship.
Megan, have you heard though with the alternative documentation of income that they use gross income and they don't take out the pre-tax deductions? What can borrowers do about that? Is it just a matter of like you have to fight back and be like, excuse me, you forgot to subtract my 401k contributions? Because that's totally what I would do.
Yeah. So what I tell folks to do is if you're submitting alternative documentation of income, that could be a pay stub, it could be a bank statement, it could be like a picture of a check that you got that month, it could be a number of things. I highly, highly, highly recommend sending in a cover letter that explains your income. So do the math for them. paint it out for them like they're a first grader, right? Like, here's my
Spoon
gross
feed the
income
info. Yep.
minus my pre-tax deductions. That's my like adjusted income for this month times how many pay periods I have a year. Circle that number. This should be my adjusted gross income. And then also explain if you filed jointly or separately. If you filed separately, they can't use your spousal income, even if they ask for it. If you filed jointly, you're going to have to send in your spouse's income information too. So the cover letter can really help explain it, keep it simple, really boil it down to just what that number should be and have supporting documentation with it. They're probably just going to look at the number you circled and use that, honestly. I don't think they're going to do a deep dive. So that's
I
what I would
say just
suggest.
a little cliff note here. Do not use Angi to commit fraud. We get this question a lot from
Yes.
self-employed business owners. Hey, what if I just like for 1 month paid myself less, right, on paper? And so I can issue a pay stub that shows I'm actually paid this like artificially low amount. Yeah, that's fraud. So don't do that.
Yeah, we do not recommend fraud in any form or fashion.
Because they can audit you, right? No, I mean, we don't
Yeah.
really talk about that, but they can audit you.
They can audit you and they can fine you. That's a very real thing. It can happen, and that would be a really crappy situation to be in. And at the end of the day, your payment should be based off of your income. We're talking about income-driven payments, so the payment should be based off of the income that you're bringing in. So we just need to be honest, right? Yes,
Yeah.
maybe you make a great income, so that means your payment sucks. It's going to be higher, but you make a great income. So be honest, always be honest. Do not falsify documents or intentionally leave things out of your income calculation. So
So without further ado, people are waiting for what is this PSLF buyback? We are getting so many questions about this program because it's new.
yes, it came out about a year ago, so it's not subject to the things that are being argued right now. It should not be something that they take away. PSLF buyback, it's kind of a second chance at getting credit for forbearance months or months that did not qualify for PSLF. So there's a couple requirements here for PSLF buyback, and this is not something that everyone can do right now. The PSLF buyback is, think about it as like delayed gratification. You can only apply for this when you, with all repayment and all forbearances that you're looking to buy back, you're already at 120 payments. So let's just take somebody who's supposed to get forgiveness in December as an example. These months of forbearance right now are not counting. You're probably going to have 4, 5, 6 months of forbearance that's not counting towards PSLF. We can't do anything about it right now, but in December, you go ahead and still apply for PSLF as if you are supposed to have 120 payments, as if you're about to get the loan forgiveness. And what you do pretty much immediately is submit this PSLF buyback request. And the buyback request, what it does is it says, hey, these are the months I was in forbearance. And you can see your itemized months in the studentaid.gov website now, which is pretty cool. Definitely go check it out if you haven't already. But if you're working towards PSLF and soon, the IDR payment tracker should be there as well. But right now, the PSLF tracker is there. Go look at all the itemized months that they're counting. It'll separate out the ones that they have already counted and the ones that need certification and the ones that they're not counting because maybe they were in forbearance. You want to pick those months out that you were in forbearance and say, I want to pay for these months. They take that information back. They come back to you with a lump sum, and you pay that lump sum to achieve the loan forgiveness right then and there. Because we've met 120 payments with that lump sum that you're paying for those forbearance months.
So basically, if you're like want to buy back those months and it's only 3 months, that's going to bring you to 93. They won't let you do that because it doesn't bring you past the 120. So that's a requirement. It has to bring you past that 120 threshold you need for PSLF.
So we can't do that now unless we're already pretty much at the point of knocking on the door of forgiveness.
And so people want to know, we're getting this question all the time. Well, what's my payment going to be? Like, what is the cost of the buyback? And they're doing like a another two-part calculation, right? They're looking at either like what your payment was right before the forbearance or what it was after the forbearance, or they might ask you for a tax return.
Yes, correct. They say if you were on an income-driven plan, that the payment would be based off of what that income-driven payment should have been. Now, the question is, what if SAVE doesn't count towards PSLF because they repeal it? I think what they would do is use basically what that save payment is, but backwards calculate it into what repay would be because that's what save replaced. And then that's what the lump sum would be based off of, that payment times however many months you're asking for. Because most people were in repayment. They were already in repayment on an income-driven plan. So hopefully that calculation is pretty easy and pretty manageable because even if save gets repealed, maybe it's just based off of the repay calculation, which was, it depends on exactly what your numbers are, but it could be between like $75 to $150 more expensive than what it was on save potentially by how they calculated it. So now if you weren't on an income-driven plan, then what they would do is they would look at that year's tax return. So that's what you would need to supply for them to calculate what the payment would have been if you were on the cheapest income-driven plan at the time. So if that's something that you know that you're going to need to do in the future, it's best to save up for that because it's going to be a lump sum and it'll be due within 90 days of you receiving that confirmation on how much you have to pay. So you need to have that ready to go to pay as a lump sum so you could be done on time. One other question we've been getting is there is one little sentence in the terms and conditions of the PSLF buyback language, which this is all on the studentaid.gov website. Just Google PSLF buyback and it'll pull it up. One of the technicalities says that you can't buy back months on a consolidation loan, which sounds a little scary at first because that means a lot of people do have consolidation loans. So you're thinking like, what? What does that even mean? What they're meaning is, so kind of backing up, when you have a consolidation loan, it's a brand new loan. They consider it a brand new loan. And a lot of people may have consolidated right after graduation or recently for the IDR account adjustment to correct their payment count or to correct their loan types. So the new consolidation loan, whenever that date was, we can buy back as far back as that consolidation settled. We can't buy back anything before that time period. With that being said, we can buy back for most people who had already consolidated, were sitting in this annoying forbearance. We can buy back these months. So that's a good thing. Now, but what if you're someone who had some forbearance pre-consolidation? Well, a couple things. One, it should have been taken care of from the IDR account adjustment, which we're still awaiting the payment counts to be completely finalized here soon.
This is the little boy who cried wolf, because I feel like we've been hearing about this payment tracker, not the PSLF one, the
I
IDR one.
know.
This payment tracker is coming. I feel like we've been hearing about it for almost 2 years.
I've been so excited about it too. Like it's gonna help so many people like just feel more confident in where they're at with their payment count and like be able to hold them to it, like for where they're at.
So rumor has it, this is the month, right? End of month, maybe, is what we're
Rumor
hearing.
has it, it's supposed to be end of this month, and we've seen evidence of them trying to add up the payment counts in not the data files, like I wish it was in the data files, but actually in your student aid portal. There's like a way that you can go in and see what they're starting to estimate. So hopefully end of this month, end of September, we're going to see that payment count for the IDR account adjustment. But with that said, the PSLF payment tracker is already there, but we're still waiting on that IDR payment count adjustment, which is supposed to count prior forbearances, time and repayment, make sure that you should be credited with all the months that you should have. That's kind of the first line of defense, is if you are trying to make sure that you're getting all the credit possible, but you see forbearances before your consolidation, they might count. We just might not see it yet because the IDR account adjustment isn't being credited quite yet. If not, so let's say if not, the IDR account adjustment is done. Doesn't look like those months that you're looking at pre-consolidation are going to count. What you could do is submit an FSA complaint, which I think you're the complaint queen, Sim.
Yes. So FSA is kind of like your first stop. This is my hot take because I think I'm in the minority, but I don't think you're going to find a lot of success there. But that is your first stop, right? You're establishing a paper trail. So you're kind of going up the chain of command. So start with FSA, kind of document everything. Hey, I was placed into this forbearance. I was steered into forbearance by my servicer between, these dates. And I shouldn't have been. I wasn't told about income-driven repayment, or maybe I was like, 2 months away from the cutoff. I didn't quite meet the definition of 12 months consecutive, 36 months or more total. I was like really close, right? On a case-by-case basis, they will still give you credit for that. FSA is your first stop. My favorite place, I feel like such a Karen. I have a favorite place to complain, but here we are. My favorite place to complain, you guys, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Why is that? Because the entity against whom you are complaining has 60 days to respond. They literally have to respond to you. They can't keep ghosting you. I have been through this process myself with my husband's loans. We filed a complaint against Mohela. They took 59 days to respond. So right up,
Wow.
you know, they used the whole time, but they did have to respond, and we did have resolution. So that's one stop. Another place is your constituent services of your local congressperson, I guess, depending on, you know, if you feel like that's going to be helpful. If you have like a congressperson who cares about, you know, education issues, or they really care about their constituents. Granted, you're not going to be working with that congressperson. You're going to be working with like a staffer. But either way, I think that can also be helpful. And not just for student loans. I mean, you can contact them for literally anything. You have like an IRS issue or non-financial, like that's what your tax dollars are for.
Yep. So those are good, some backup options. And we may not know if we need those options yet, but these are things to put in your back pocket for later. And once we start to learn more about the fate of the Save Plan, once we start to learn more about what the IDR account adjustment looks like for your loan payment count, your loan situation, then it can help you piece together kind of your next steps. With that said, this episode should give you a couple things to put in your back pocket for later because there's a lot of unknown, but we need to know how to pivot. And so we've got a lot of pivotable ways that we could go about things depending on what's happening here coming up. So we'll continue to keep you posted. And thanks, Tim, for joining me on this podcast episode. Any last words?
Just know that knowledge is power. And I know it's a corny thing to say, but when you know your options, you can make good decisions. Don't feel like you have to do any one thing right now. Just arm yourself with knowledge, and then, you know, don't feel stressed about taking your time to make a decision about what's best for your student loans, because things might
Right.
change again anyway in your favor.
Yeah. And we're here for you. We'll keep you posted as time goes on and as things start to unfold. Thanks for trusting us with your game plan. And if you need one-on-one help, we're here. We're able to really map out all your different options. So book a consult with us if you need that one-on-one support. And we've got plenty of free content on our website as well. So check that out. Free calculators as well. Stay positive, keep moving forward, focus on something that makes you happy today, and we'll see you on the next one.